Hello, and welcome to Coming to Be. Our guest today is someone that I have been looking forward to interviewing, looking forward to having a conversation with. He's actually a personal friend of mine. I refer to him as a brother on the move. We've known each other for a few years now. But let me just read off some prepared comments just to give you a little bit of an idea of the person that we got coming to visit with us today. At the age of 13, as a result of a lack of parental guidance and trauma, he began experimenting with alcohol, marijuana for relief and escape, which led to a progressive of teenage arrests, poor grades in school, severe interruption of his developmental stages. By the age of 19, he was a full-blown drug addict as well as addicted to cocaine. This led to multiple incarcerations, self-harm, mental decompensation. Addiction caused him to commit crimes to support his drug habit that included selling of drugs to others to support his addiction, as well as petty theft to support his daily drug use. At the age of 35, he was arrested for robbery in Suffolk County, New York, which led him to facing 5 years in state penitentiary. This was an eye-opening experience for him. Being at his bottom, he took a plea deal for 6 months jail time and 5 years of felony probation. He was motivated at that point to change his life and recover from the disease of addiction, he began attending 12-step self-help groups. When he achieved one year of recovery, he was offered a job as a drug counselor at a facility that he actually had been a patient in 7 times. This was the beginning. His journey began at that point as a drug and alcohol treatment professional. And let me just tell you a little bit about what he's accomplished since then. He has an associate's degree in human services. He has a bachelor's degree in human services. He has multiple credentials, including certified alcohol abuse counselor in New York, international certified clinical supervisor, certified recovery specialist, certified family recovery specialist, and I mentioned earlier, he has a bachelor's degree in human services. Yo, without further ado, I'm gonna introduce you to somebody that is a power broker. He is a brother on the move, and he is a personal friend of mine, my man, Mr. Kenneth Ramirez. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vasya.
I can't even begin to tell you how excited I am and motivated. We can move to prepared comments now because you and I, we just gonna talk like we always talk.
Yes, sir.
To have someone this close in proximity to me that not only has the experience that you have, but has experienced the indescribable transformative power of self-discipline, and as we both acknowledge, a form of power greater than ourselves. We'll talk about that a little bit too. And then watch it become fruitful, and watch it not only fill our own lives, but to spill over and to be able to help other people do some of the things that we have done, and possibly even greater than what we have done. And let that be our reward. Mm-hmm. So again, I cannot tell you how excited I am to have you here on the show.
Thank you.
I think I'd like to start with, you know, we heard about all the things that happened as a teenager to you in your younger childhood and your adolescence, and incarceration and drug addiction and the dealing of drugs and so on and so forth. But to go from that to the beginning of the process of where you are now wasn't just something that you didn't just go to bed one night and say, like, you know what? I think I'm done with this. I think I want to change my life now.
Right.
I know that there is such a thing as divine intervention.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there is something called spirituality and spiritual development and awakeness. And what I think my first question to you is, where were you when that happened? When you crashed, which I'm sure wasn't for the first time, But when you crashed and that moment occurred to you, I'm done. I can't do this no more. I don't know what I'm going to do next, but it can't be no this. More of this. When did where were you at when that happened for you?
I was sitting on the corner on Bushwick Avenue on Mesereau Street in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And it was a hot summer day, about 80, 90 degrees outside. And I ran out of all my money. And I was sitting in front of a Spanish bodega with a 50-cent can of hot beer. And with my MacGyver thinking, trying to figure out what was next. And, you know, for me at that time, when I look at that day, that moment, that was really the end of the road for me, you know. Two New York City police officers just happened to turn the corner that was walking the beat, you know. And when they turned the corner, there I was with this can of beer in my hand. But in this case, you know, these officers were, you know, when I look back on that, they were actually angels. And I'm going to tell you why. You know, they turned the corner and they said, "How you doing, sir?" And, you know, "You're drinking some alcohol in public, but don't worry about it. We're just going to run your name to, you know, see if there's any warrants, anything. Sure. If not, you can sit there and finish the beer." And, you know, I felt a little bit of relief. And I'm talking to them, and, you know, 2 minutes later, over the radio, dispatch said that I had an outstanding warrant that I had no idea I had,
you know,
for some addiction-related crimes. And I remember when they asked me to stand up and put the handcuffs on me and said they had to take me in, I felt a relief. Like, I was tired, man. I just ain't know how to stop or what else to do. So for me, they weren't just cops. They were angels, man, you know. And that, for me, that was part of my divine intervention to start the upward trajectory for me to, you know, start changing my life. Right. That was the beginning.
That was the moment.
That was the moment.
Wow. And again, not knowing exactly what you were going to do after that, but you were clear that it wasn't going to be what you had been doing.
Yes.
That's all you had to go with. That was over.
That was over.
But we didn't know where we were headed.
No. I was just happy they was taking me somewhere. I was getting out the streets.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
I was looking forward to sleeping in a bed, you know.
Regardless of where it was.
Well, regardless of where it was, man. It wasn't going to be the project hallway staircase that night. It wasn't going to be in a abandoned building that night. I knew where I was going, and I knew that as long as I got some rest, I had another opportunity to try to get it right, man.
Mm.
You know?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then from that point, you're in New York,
mm-hmm.
and I can only assume that you were locked up for a short period of time as a result of that.
Well, what happened was they took me to Rikers Island, right, for the warrant. And while I was on Rikers Island, the hold for the warrant dropped on me. And they gave me a very high bail. They contacted Suffolk County, Long Island, who came and got me.
Is that where the warrant was at?
That's where the warrant was at. Because I was in Suffolk County in a program that I was sent to for one of my previous attempts at trying to get it right. And I wound up leaving that program in Suffolk County, using drugs and alcohol out there and committing a crime, you know.
Mm.
Just full transparency, I robbed a cab driver for $30.
$30. Wow.
For crack cocaine.
And when you think about that level of desperation
mm-hmm.
in the here and now, what runs through your mind?
I had to split it three ways because I had two people with me. So
it was a RICO. Yeah. It was a $30 RICO case.
Yeah. So when I look back on that, right, like in that state of desperation, you know, I was facing 5 years of my life. You know, prison isn't safe, man. Anything can happen.
Right. Anything does happen.
County jail's not safe. You know, I seen guys in county jail get hit in the head for the phone, all kinds of things, man. So going into any kind of those environments, there's nothing safe about it, you know? And when I look back on that and I say, man, I almost, you know, 5 years, man, you know, that I could have lost in my life, you know, for
everything, including you.
Everything, including my life. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about some more positive things that began to happen for you at that point. Mm-hmm. What would you say was the first step toward your change? What would you say was the first action that you took? And the reason why I ask on such a granular level, mm-hmm, is because the people in our audience, I want to have for them something tangible, mm-hmm, and the something realistic that they can begin to think about or to use. You know, like, it's one thing to say, like, well, I went back to school to get my bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, but you didn't just go back to school to get you, like, there were some steps involved before you did that.
Absolutely.
So that's why I ask such granular questions, because, mm-hmm, I want people that are listening to be able to hear myself, you, and be able to get up tomorrow morning and say, like, so that's something I could do.
Right.
That's something I could try. So with that said, what was, like, one of the first things that you kind of did to change your dilemma?
I was willing to do anything.
No, I got you.
Praying, going to these meetings, and I started to take risks, right, in a room full of tough guys that used to go to these meetings to do other things, but I was going to the meeting because I was really afraid. And I started to raise my hand with all these criminals around me like myself, and I started to share about I was scared, how drugs kicked my butt, I was homeless, I didn't want to do it no more. And it's real strength in being able to get real like that, mm-hmm, because it made me look at myself and say, you know, for a lot of my life, I hid behind this image, this facade. Mm-hmm. You know, I needed to always be somebody else. Well, I thought I did, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you know? And never got me anything, you know? I still felt empty inside, trying to be everything to please somebody else, you, mm-hmm, know? Like, I made the time count in bettering myself. You know, I used to get up every morning, and I still do this, man, and I spent time with God. You know, I would pray, and the hit is that 2 months into that process, I got a call one day from the prison chapel. The jail chapel, I forgot the nun's name, but she called me down, correction officers, walked me downstairs. And when I got in there, my mother was on the phone, on speakerphone. She said, Ken, have a seat. The nun, she said, have a seat. She said, your mom is on the phone. And I'm like, what's up, Ma? And she told me that she got diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and had 6 months to live. And I broke down crying, man. Because the first thing that went through my mind is I'm going to do 5 years and my mother's gonna die while I'm in prison. You know, and I remember, man, like, I went back to my cell that night and I cried and I prayed and I said, God, please. Please, just give me one more chance. Like, I'm all in. I'm all in. Whatever you want from me. Mm. Just please help me change my life. And it wasn't no foxhole prayer. It was for real. It was from my heart. And I believe that God heard my prayer, man. You know? And my faith started to grow through that whole process. Yeah, I was scared, but I kept praying and I kept showing up anyway, man.
Yeah, yeah. You know? So in listening to you, which I have such respect, not only for what you did, but continuing to be able to be honest about what you did, mm-hmm. And be vulnerable with myself and the audience and stuff, I appreciate that tremendously. But it sounds to me like your first effort to help yourself was after this acknowledgement that you were in the situation you were in, mm-hmm. that possibly for the first time with sincerity, mm-hmm. you reached out for help. It just, in this case, your prayer was to God, right? But prior to that, you apparently had demonstrated some things to some people, inmates included, mm-hmm. your level of sincerity.
Yes.
So God didn't just, or whatever it was you was praying to, didn't just, because I would venture to say you probably had prayed a couple times before.
I have.
right. But one of the things that was different this time was that your sincerity had reached a point where you were not just willing to pray, but after your prayer, you was ready to get up and take some footsteps in the direction your prayer.
That's right.
Interesting and accurate. I have more similarities than differences than with you. So I enjoy just seeing the parallels.
Thank you.
In our life. So to move forward, so then at some point you became aware, apparently, that for you at least, education was a not the way, but one of the ways.
That's right.
Out of your current predicament.
Yes.
So your first, let's just call it educational goal, was what?
Well, my first educational goal was, let me back up a little bit, right? After that whole process of getting that call with my mom and everything,
right?
God sent me an angel. I got a legal aid who believed in me. My charge got reduced from a violent robbery to a nonviolent robbery. Person I took $30 from was a cab driver, and he said that he thinks that I may have had a weapon on me, and I didn't have a weapon on me, but in New York State, they can get a grand jury indictment on appeared to be a weapon. Okay. So they got the
indictment. Your hand in your pocket saying
they could say it might have been a pistol, and you could get indicted on an armed robbery, okay. without even having appeared to be.
Okay.
And she was able to prove that I didn't have a weapon. I admitted to taking the $30 to support my drug addiction, and that's how I got the 6 months and 5 years felony probation. So when I got out of there, I was on Social Security disability. So I had been placed on SSI disability back in 2007 for my mental health conditions, you know, my anxiety, my bipolar disorder and things like that. And I was deemed fully disabled by the Social Security Administration in 2007 by SSI law administrative judge, who said that I wasn't capable of managing my own funds. So I had a representative payee who managed my funds for me.
Okay.
And, you know, going through this process of rehabilitation, you know, I started to feel like there was more for me other than just staying home and collecting a check. And I'm not saying anything's wrong with that, but right. for me—
If it's valid.
For me, I wanted more, right? Like I said, you know, I'm not gonna let this disability or my past define with God, what I feel God has for me and wants me to do in my life. And I took a risk and I started to look for jobs when I got out. And my first job was the cart guy at Pathmark that you see.
Get out.
They're in the cart.
Get out.
Yeah.
So get out.
I was the cart guy. I got respect for those guys, man. And ladies, I got respect for the cart person, you know. And I remember, man, it was winter time and I'm out there getting those carts and I'm just saying, God, thank you. And I'm pushing the carts and putting them together. I was grateful, man, because I knew something special was happening. And back then, that was in 2010. It's like maybe $9 an hour. I don't know what it was, man. I was just happy to have a job.
Right. Yeah. I'm digging
and,
it.
I was doing the right thing, right? Like, I was staying clean. When I went on a job interview, I told them I was on felony probation. I didn't lie on the application. And I was just excited, man. Like, they gave me a chance. And knowing that this may jeopardize my SSI benefits because now I'm working. But I was willing to take the risk so I could start rebuilding my life. And 3 weeks into that, I got a call into the manager's office and they said they had to let me go. And the cart guy, and I was devastated. And I cried. I said, but I was honored.
What was the reasoning?
They didn't give me one. I didn't lie on the application or nothing. I told the truth. I checked off I had a conviction in the section for the explanation. I wrote that I had a nonviolent felony and they let me go.
Okay.
No reason at all. You know, okay. They just said it was related to my background check and I couldn't understand why. Because okay. I was honest.
Right.
And I lost hope after that. But I continued to go to these meetings that I was going to and people said, don't worry, just keep coming, right. Kenny, and just right. keep putting right. one foot forward. And one day I was at a meeting, self-help meeting,
uh-huh.
and I raised my hand and said I needed a job. And if anybody in there knew about any jobs, could they please let me know after the meeting? During this time, my wife today, which was my fiance then, was pregnant with our daughter. And I was scared. I said, I'm on SSI. I got a baby on the way. I'm scared. And I did the best thing that I knew how in my new life was to reach out for help. And this lady approached me after the meeting named Diana. And she says, look, Kenny, she says, I see you and your girlfriend been coming to these meetings and I usually don't do this. But she says, you never know who's watching you in here. And I seen y'all been coming. She says, so I work at a treatment facility in Long Island and in the Hamptons. And she said, they're looking for part-time workers. So I'm gonna bring you an application here to the meeting next week. Be here at the meeting next week and I'm gonna bring you the application. I was at the meeting next week, filled out the application and I got hired. And that was my first job in the treatment center.
Wow. Wow. Yo, I'm still bugging on the cart guy.
Yeah. Because I love those guys. When I go shopping, I make sure I put the cart in
the bulkhead.
I
bet you do.
Yes, I do.
I bet you do.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
And I
take pride in it.
And I'm laughing, although I'm kind of checking myself while I'm laughing, because I know that there are pockets of our society that I refer to as the invisible.
Yeah.
With a lot of our immigrants falling into that category, like, you know, the busboys and the stuff like that, like, they're just invisible in our society for whatever reason. And you know, to my own discredit, I kind of looked at the cart guys like that. Mm-hmm. Like, they were just kind of invisible to me. And then listening to you, like, mm-hmm. How wrong is that? So I'm really, as I'm listening to you, I'm kind of checking myself also, saying like, yo, nobody's invisible, Bashir.
Give him a pound next time you see him.
You know what I'm saying? Or even a hello.
Yeah.
Hey, how you
how
doing?
How you doing?
You know what I'm saying? Just let somebody know that they're not invisible.
That's
like,
right.
Wow, like what a hit that is. You know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So we start this journey. So now you got yourself part-time, but I don't want to say a real job because the cart guy's a real job.
That's
too.
Right. That's
so
right.
So let's say it's your second real job.
Yeah.
But it's in a venue that has potential.
Yes.
Yes. And I'm willing to bet, just knowing who you are now, as soon as you landed in that petri dish of potential, mm-hmm. I bet no sooner than you were hired as a blank, you probably had your eye on the next spot.
Yes, I did.
Because I know how you get down.
Yes, I did.
I know how you get down. Very
yes,
similar to myself. Like, you may see what I'm doing now, but I'm doing what I'm doing now because I got my eye on something over there.
That's right.
Right, right. That's how we do.
I'm telling you.
So, and I would guess that that next thing that you saw was something that was full-time, because you mentioned that your wife was expecting and things like that.
She had the baby while I was working there at that part-time treatment center in the Hamptons in Long Island.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And where were you living? You were living out that way?
I was living out there. Yeah, I was living out there. Because remember, when I was on Rikers Island, Suffolk County put the warrant hold on me and they came and got me. They came and got me from Rikers Island and brought me out to Suffolk County Jail. And that's how all the other process
started. Right.
You know, so when I got released from there in 5.5 months, I was in Suffolk County.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're working part-time as a
therapeutic aide.
Okay.
And what that is a behavioral health technician.
Okay.
A tech.
All right. So basically saying, come on, guys, it's time for group.
Yes.
Come on, it's 9 o'clock. Cut the lights off.
Yeah, I seen you pass her that letter. Give me the letter.
Right. All of that misbehaving.
All of that. I was the guy that kind of monitored. And let me tell you, you know what the eye opener for me was? Mm. That facility that I got that first part-time job in was the one I was the client at 7 times previous to that. They used to send a van to Brooklyn to pick me up from the projects to bring me to that treatment center.
Right.
So just to walk the halls, on the other side of it, you talk about like hope and my mind was blown away. Like I could really do something. Like I could really change my life. How this happened? I'm an employee at a place I was a client at? Yo, like that right there just gave me hope, man. I'm like, anything is possible now.
So that next thing that you had your eye on wasn't just a abstract goal. You really walking around with a chest full of hope.
Yes.
Saying like, because if I could come from that
from the
where I am now,
yes,
anything's possible.
Anything is possible. Anything. Anything.
You see, and that's really the message right there. Like, we could wrap this up right now, because that's the message right there that. because I said it at the end of our last show, once you can begin to renounce self, mm-hmm. that's when the journey begins.
That's right.
And in listening to your story, what I'm hearing is once you began to renounce your own sick desires, let's just call it for lack of a better word, and allow yourself to be vulnerable to whatever.
Right.
But the truth of the matter is, we don't really know what we're allowing ourselves to be vulnerable to. We're just allowing ourselves to be open to something better than what we've been doing for the past whatever amount of years.
But that's the key, allowing ourselves to be open, man. You know, like I think about like a lot of the times like in my life where I stayed like in relationships too long or, you know, any kind of situation that was bad too long. Knowing it was bad, but scared to leave that situation for the unknown. Because this is bad, but at least I know it. Right. So I'll stay with what I know versus letting that go and trying something different and taking a risk.
Right.
For something better, more productive. Because, you know, it's a lot of risk in that.
Right. Because who knows?
Who knows?
Right. One of the interesting things, I spend a decent amount of time talking to people about feelings and just our understanding of feelings. And one of the things I've learned about feelings is that they feel like they're forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're, when you're sad, it kind of feels like I'm going to be sad forever.
Forever.
When you,
it does.
When you
it
broke.
Does.
When you broke.
Feels like we're going to be broke forever.
It feels like
you're
going to be broke forever, right? How about when you got a pocket full of money and all the bills are paid and everything's going great? Doesn't it feel like it's going to be forever? Like everything's going to be great forever?
Yeah.
And I think one of the signs of maturity for anybody is understanding that whatever is going on today
mm-hmm.
is not forever.
That's right.
Whatever it is. Whatever it is. So even if it
things are bad or indifferent,
you better recognize that it ain't forever.
Mm-hmm.
It is not forever. So, so many pearls of wisdom I'm just thinking of as just in conversation with just one of the reasons I was looking forward to having you on the show.
Me too, man.
So we began this journey of education, wanting to improve ourselves through education. But again, I'm gonna take a risk and say that if I know you the way I think you know I know you, you probably were saying to yourself, once I get this degree or this certification, I'll be eligible for this. And then you got there and you said, now if I had this certification or degree, I'd be eligible for that. And it just began a sort of climb.
Yes.
Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So like 6 months into that place that I was working part-time in my first job in addiction treatment, they didn't have any more hours like for full-time employment. And I, you know, my wife had the baby while I was working there.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm feeling, you know, I just experienced like, you know, bringing paychecks home for a few months is feeling good. I'm not spending my money on drugs and alcohol. I'm starting to experience what it is to be a productive and responsible member of society for the first time in my life, you know?
And you liked it.
And I liked it, man. I liked it. And I said, I need a full-time job. So now I got about 6-7 months of a therapeutic aid behavioral health technician under
me. Yeah, you got a resume now.
I got a resume. I ain't never have no resume, you
right,
know?
Right, right.
And I started sending my resume out. And I got hired by another full-time, well, I got hired by another addiction treatment center in Long Island full-time as a behavioral health technician. And while I was there, I stayed there for about 2.5 years. Right, so now I'm working over 2 years, right? I'm full-time. SSI had gave me a grace period where you're allowed to make a certain amount of money for the first year. And I made a decision to surrender my SSI benefits to maintain gainful employment.
That was a leap of faith.
Yes, it was.
That was a huge leap of faith.
Yes, it was.
I can only imagine having the certainty mm-hmm. of income from wherever
mm-hmm.
and saying, no more.
No more.
I'll do it on my own now.
That's right.
Thank you for when I needed you,
mm-hmm.
but I'm okay now. I'm gonna do it on my own.
I had to trust God, man, and know that He equipped me with everything that I was gonna need to be able to be okay. And you know, right, my circumstances, what I realized is that my past circumstances didn't have to be my conclusion.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Like new chapters was possible. And like I was able to open new doors and reinvent myself. Right? And like while I was at that new place that I was working full time, I was working overnight. I took the overnight shift, but it was a full-time
job. Take what nobody
job.
Else wants.
That's right.
Give me what nobody else
That's
wants.
Right.
I'll do it.
I took it full-time, 40 hours a week. And an opportunity arose while I was there. The organization received a grant for 5 employees to go to school to be a counselor. And I remember the director, her name was Charlene. She came up to me one day and asked me if I was interested. And without my permission, I just said yes. But I'm gonna tell you, while I was saying yes, I'm saying, I work overnight. Like, how am I going to do this? I got a new baby. But I just said yes.
Right.
And I went to school, man, for like the next year to be trained as to get the counseling addiction, specific addiction counseling training. And, you know, I took the exam after that, the international exam to get credentialed as a counselor, which they call KSACS in New York. So I had to take that ICRC exam, and I took that and I passed. I remember I had to go to Queens one morning. It was snowing that morning, and I drove to Queens to go take the exam because that was the closest location. And it was a 150 question exam, Pasha. And I took the exam, man. And they tell you what the results are.
Right then.
As soon as you hit submit, and you come out the room, and you know, they got people watching. That's like a real exam. It's like a state exam. They print it out and they tell you 5 minutes later. So I hit submit and I'm coming out and I'm standing outside now by the desk. And I'm like, oh man, what's gonna happen here? You know? And she printed out and she gave it to me and I looked at it and I passed. Do you know that I fell on my knees in that office? I get chills talking about it and I broke down crying like a baby. Mm. Snots and boogers coming out my nose.
Right, right.
And she's like, sir, they taking the test in there. And I just said, miss, you don't understand. Miss, you don't understand. This is gonna change my life. You don't understand.
You and what we are talking about warrants a part two. So if you would indulge me in coming back to the studio,
it would be an honor, man.
Part two, because I want to talk about your is it a recovery house or a halfway house?
Recovery house.
I want to talk about your recovery house that you opened in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about some of the attention that it has gotten both politically,
mm-hmm.
as well as in the, I guess you would refer to it as the recovering community.
Yes.
So politically, as well as in the recovering community. And I'd like to talk to you as granular and as in depth as possible about, so what you got your eye on now? Because I just get the feeling that you're not done.
I ain't done yet, brother on the move.
You're not done yet, man. So I guess we'll work toward winding down and concluding today's interview. But man, this might even be a three-parter or something. I don't know, but I think we can do it in two. But it has just been more than an honor. It's
same, man. Thank you.
Like, when I talk to people like you, it forces me to look at myself.
Mm.
See, a lot of times, I believe a lot of people don't like looking at themselves. And I might not like looking at myself,
mm-hmm.
but I know the value of looking at myself.
Right.
And when I talk to people like you, it in any area that I'm beginning to tire or fatigue, it lets me know, like, don't you even think about it. There's so much more that we can do.
Yes.
There's so many more people that need and want our help. And if whatever this source of power is that has either chosen us or we have chosen it, is not done with us.
No.
And it is not because, and I'm sure I feel confident that you'll agree with me with this, it is nothing to do with what we have done or what we deserve. In fact, if we were to receive what we deserved,
we wouldn't be here.
We sure wouldn't be sitting here. We might be sitting somewhere, but it wouldn't be here. So obviously it's not anything that we've done to deserve it. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it's not about me or you.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be about others. And I don't know about dedicating my life to helping others. Or I don't know that I use that type of language necessarily, but I understand that the value of my life has to do with increasing the value of other people's lives. I know that somehow, some way, that those two wagons are hitched together.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And my job is to remain conscious of that and listen to this spirit that's within me that lets me know when I lay eyes on, because everybody I lay eyes on doesn't speak to my spirit and say, like, I'm going to help this guy. It doesn't kind of work like that for me. I just kind of intuitively know, based on the moment, possibly what comes out the person's mouth, possibly the energy that I pick up off of them.
The energy.
But I'll use the word assignments, but throughout my day or days, I'm introduced to various assignments where I'm needed. It could be the teller at the bank. It could be the cashier at Walmart.
Or the cart guy.
Or the cart guy. God damn. Or the cart guy.
That's right.
Yo, that's like a t-shirt.
I'm telling you, man.
Did you say hello to the cart guy?
How about that?
You think you humble? You think you humble? Did you say hello to the cart guy?
Steep, man.
Fucking Kenny Ramirez, man. This shit. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
You see what I'm saying? Because, yo, there's levels to this thing, man. There's levels to this thing. And people think that when I say that, they may hear there's levels to this thing. What I'm saying is there's levels to this thing. Mm-hmm. It ain't going that way. It ain't taking me that way. That's my ego.
Right.
When I say there's levels to this thing,
humility.
There's a humility that continues to gain more depth so that I can go to the greasier person, to the darker person,
right,
to the place that I would never go, lower than where I've been before.
That's right.
And have an understanding just from a humane perspective of, I was sent here for you.
Mm-hmm.
And know what it is that I need to do for you to help begin to pull you from the hole that you're currently in. There probably are several religions or great orators that can say what I just said in a very profound, dynamic way. But I'm a street vendor.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
I didn't make that up. One of my mentors gave that to me. I'm a street vendor. I don't meet you at the pulpit.
That's right.
I don't meet you in the masjid. I don't meet you in a particular
place of worship.
That ain't. I'm gonna meet you at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna meet you at the spot. I'm gonna meet you coming out of Walmart with your pajama pants on and your slippers and your hair in rollers, thinking like there's nothing wrong with that shit. That's where I'm gonna meet you at.
Mm-hmm.
And be able to say, bro, come on, man, like for real, for real. Like there's another way, and you know there's another way. I'm willing to help you if you're willing to help yourself. You know what I mean? And things like that, so.
That's real, man.
I can't even, listen, the cart guy by itself, that's you know what I mean? But listen, the respect that I have for you, the acknowledgement of the work that you've put in, the discipline, like expecting wife. I know that that position that you talked about, the technician behavioral, like that ain't no big time job. Like that was your jump off point. Like,
yes.
I get that. And your wife was expecting, and you like, you know, and then the luggage that you bring in from your past with you, kind of thing, and the people that, because people are testing, people are very testing, and the people that tested you along the way, where part of you are saying like, I will knock mother like that thing that we got that still resides in us.
Yeah.
That we have to pray and meditate and convince ourselves and surrender that thing.
Yeah.
To let this new thing inside of us work through us.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know the commit. Like faith is great, and belief is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But we get to a level with this thing where we have to know.
That's right.
Like, you know it's real or you don't. Like, I used to believe. I used to have faith.
But you know.
I used to hope. I used to hold on. But now.
I know.
I ain't got to believe nothing. Because my resume, the evidence in my life is stacked so like believe.
I know.
Believe.
Right.
We way past believing. We way past hoping. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You talked about the vehicle I had. I said, man, please, man, look at you, man. Stop it. Yo, this is a part two without doubt, brother. I just hope
Thank
that
you,
your
Boston.
Schedule permits you to come join us again in the
anything,
studio.
Anything.
Because I do want to hear some more about that recovery house that you got. I believe it's just for men at this point anyway.
Yeah, just for men.
Yep. You know, if it's anything like what I think it is, there will probably be a chain of recovery houses thanks to you and the good work that you're doing. So in any event, thanks for joining us. We look forward to having you at our next show. If I cannot have Mr. Ramirez here for our next show, I'll certainly try to have him here in the very near future so that we can continue this conversation, because I know if not for anybody else, it's been wonderful for me. And listen, be sure to say hello to the cart guy.
Thank you.